Very, very good. Okay, we are at 10 minutes after 10, and our auditor, Mr. Ross Wisdom, is with us. I see him in the audience. Hi, Ross. So I would like to go ahead and introduce Ross Wisdom, and in our jumble of cables, figure out where he's going to make his presentation from so that we could have our open session portion of the auditor's report.
Do you want to reduce this to 50 minutes or extend the time to 11:10?
I'm at the will of the body. Is there an inclination one way? Let's just extend it 10 minutes in case Ross needs it.
Without objection.
Thank you. Very good. Ali?
I have a point of personal inquiry. Is this meeting supposed to be streaming live? Because it apparently is not streaming. I'm getting emails, and I'm trying to get the stream myself.
Thank you, Ali. Okay. These speakers are inconveniently located. It interferes with the view. We're going to have to figure something out over lunch. Yes, I'm going to push it. Thank you, Ross. I apologize for the speakers kind of in your line of sight. We're going to have to make some adjustments over lunch with those, but okay. We can hear you as long as you've got a speaker. I mean, a microphone.
We are streaming.
Thank you, John, our tireless and fearless technical crew. Are we good?
Yeah.
Excellent. Is that my mellifluous tones feeding back at me? Excellent, thank you. Mr. Wisdom, whenever you're ready, go ahead and introduce yourself, please.
This is Ross Wisdom, CPA, speaking about the audit engagement for the fiscal year ended September 30th, 2011.
One moment, please, Ross. We are having some audio issues this morning. John, are we getting him?
Yeah.
We're not really getting him. You did? Okay. Thank you.
How is this?
That's much better. Thank you.
Okay. All right. I'm glad you're all very interested in hearing me.
We do not want to miss a word.
Okay. Well, let me state that this audit engagement started upon the receipt of the engagement letter December the 5th. We've been on a very short time frame. The previous audit started much earlier in October. And it concluded, and I presented last year, February 26th, to the board, the audit report. So given the short time frame, we are still in the process of the audit. We are about, I would say, 75% complete. We have utilized our best efforts in order to produce a draft of the audit report, which has just been handed out to you. There will be some changes to this draft. I normally don't like to present any kind of preliminary audit report because sometimes it's more confusing to answer questions about subsequent changes than it is to just present the final audit. But I felt that time was of the essence. We are trying to meet the same deadline, even though we started later this year. We're still trying to meet the deadline of having the final audit by the end of February in order to submit on time for CPB. So let's go on to the draft that you have in front of you. This year, you do have a comparison report showing the current year's figures next to last year's figures so that you can easily compare the 2 years. On page one is the auditor's opinion. The last paragraph is in italics. There has not been a decision made at this point whether the going concern issue will continue as a qualification or as a disclosure item. There has been some progress made in the last year. At this point, I would not say it's sufficient progress to remove this disclosure, but it's still an open question. The jury is still out, so to speak, We're looking at the most recent budget versus actual reports. We're awaiting an approved financial recovery plan and a three-year financial projection, which could affect this disclosure. So that's why it's in italics. It may or may not appear in the final report. On the statement of financial position, I'm now looking at page 2. The pledges receivable have yet to be adjusted. We are still awaiting some of the MIMSIS reports from the various stations in order to make that adjusting entry. That adjusting entry could either be favorable or unfavorable. I'm not anticipating a substantial change from that entry, but at this point we're not sure. That would affect the financials once we make that entry. As it stands right now, there are current assets, as you'll see on page 2, of $1,777,91, compared to the year before of $1,758,005. Very similar. However, cash has improved from $410 to $602. So the cash flow is slightly better than the year before. The bottom portion is very similar to the year before in terms of the equipment and the other fixed assets. On page 3, you'll see total current liabilities of $2,651,043, $2.6 million. If you subtract current liabilities from current assets, you get a negative working capital. You don't see that number disclosed on the report. It's a number that you have to calculate. But the working capital, and I want to point this out because it's such a vital statistic, especially for nonprofit organizations, the working capital at the end of the fiscal year ended September 30, 2011, was a negative $880,000. The year before, it was a negative $810,000. So it's decreased, it's worse by about $70,000. However, there is one accounting item that I think requires further explanation, and I have had some inquiries to go into some accounting explanation for nonprofit accounting principles, etc., to help the board understand concepts such as deferred revenue, restricted funds, working capital, and cash flows, and how those interplay. It is important to be able to read these financial statements from the perspective of, you know, what do they mean and what is significant for this organization. Well, working capital is very significant because that affects the ability of the national office especially to be able to pay bills as they become due. If you have sufficient working capital, there should be no problems with meeting the payroll on time, with paying the bills on a current basis. And you don't need to sort of borrow from Peter to pay Paul, so to speak, all of the time and always try to work things out. I have seen in the past worse situations of working capital, and it has worked out. But you want to look at this working capital number and see it improve. It did not improve this year. However, I want to highlight one item, the deferred income item, which is $114,000. Now, that's an adjusting entry that we were required to make per generally accepted accounting principles. When you have a contract, which is what is involved in this case, it was the Rice University contract with KPFT, where they provided a grant of $120,000. But they stipulated in the grant very specifically that even during the initial term, that the 120 is refundable over a 7-year period. So we had to prorate that $120,000 over a 7-year period. And that meant that $114,000 is considered deferred income or deferred revenue. It will be recognized in future periods as it is, so to speak, earned, or no longer refundable. It would be refundable if there was a termination or a default in the contract. And that was done to, I guess, protect the university, although there's obviously no intention to terminate that contract, but we are still required to show the deferred income. If you remove that item from the balance sheet, which we can't do, but it's not a bill that has to, it's not like an accounts payable that has to be paid tomorrow. It's just revenue that's not recognized until it is ratably recognized over the next 6.5 years, basically. So that is really not a detriment to working capital right now. So if you take that out, then the working capital number is very, basically, essentially the same as the year before. So on a working capital basis, we're in the same situation now as we were a year ago. No significant improvement, no significant detriment. So this is a little bit of a mixed report that I'm giving you. It's not a good report, but it could have been a worse report. So the patient has sort of stabilized on the table, and we're still waiting to see, if you want to put it in layman terms. And that's what I have to say so far about the balance sheet. Key information. Also, you'll see this deferred rent liability. This is sort of a confusing concept, which frankly was a new accounting principle about 10 years ago that I personally don't entirely agree with, but I have to do it. It's when you have a rent situation with escalation clauses, then you are required to recast that rent on a straight line basis and expense it on a straight line basis over the term of the lease. And the difference between that straight line amount and the actual amount becomes, in this case, a so-called deferred rent liability. It's not really a liability. It's just an accounting mechanism that will eventually zero out over the term of the lease. And all it does is prevent you showing a lower rent in an earlier year and a much higher rent in a later year per the lease. Accounting principles want you to show the rent evenly because you've committed to the lease and they want the expense to be evenly charged. So this is also something that I think you should keep in mind, that even though we're showing a liability of $723,000 under non-current liabilities, deferred rent, again, of course, it's not a working capital item. It's not even really a cash item. It's just an accounting principle item that will eventually diminish in the future years. It didn't diminish this year because of the rent schedule. But in future years, it will gradually sort of amortize down to zero as you expense more rent in future years without causing extra cash flow at this point. So that's something I wanted to explain. Let's turn to page 4, which is the statement of activities. And you'll see three columns, as usual. The first column is considered unrestricted, no donor-imposed restrictions. The second column, temporarily restricted. And essentially what we have here is the restricted portion of the CPB grant, restricted for programming, certain programming, which was used for programming. And then you see later on net assets released from restrictions. And what that means is that although there was a restriction attached to the grant money coming in, it was used for the grant purpose. Therefore, we call it released from restriction. And then we move it over to the unrestricted column. And then we have all of the expenses under the unrestricted column. That's another accounting mechanism that's prescribed. But essentially, you have $316,872 coming in from CPB as restricted portion, and that was used during the year for the intended purposes, and it was released. There were some other funds released, which were in temporarily restricted funds at the beginning of the year that were used during the year, so you also see another $46,962 released from restrictions in the current year. Those funds have been received in a prior year, so they helped the budget this year in terms of the unrestricted budget. When we come down to the bottom line, so to speak, which for the nonprofit is called a change in net assets, because a surplus or a deficit increases or decreases your net assets. You see in the total column, we have a change in net assets of a negative $405,967. So there is a deficit this year. It's much better than the year before. If you look at page 5, the year before, the deficit was $1,974,849. So although it is not a break-even, which is what was hoped for, I believe, this year, it is an improvement. Not really enough of an improvement of what we were looking for, but a significant improvement. And obviously the goal is not even just to break even for the organization. It is also to restore working capital. And I do want to direct your attention back once again to the working capital, where I was mentioning about $800,000 as a negative working capital deficit. What should the working capital be? Well, normally you think in terms of let's have 1 month of our budget or 1 month of our cash flow in our working capital. So if things are a little slow, if we have a dry spell, we can get through a month without having to worry about paying the bills. That's the general rule of thumb. In this organization, that rule of thumb would mean having a working capital of about $1.2 million. And if you look historically, when the organization has had $1.2 million or more in its working capital, which has been most of the years, things have worked pretty smoothly financially. You haven't had past due bills. You haven't had trouble covering a payroll or something like that. So I am recommending that the working capital be restored to the $1.2 million level as soon as possible. I understand it can't be done tomorrow, but as soon as is reasonably possible, you're at a negative of 800, so you really need to restore about 2 million to get to your 1.2 million working capital. So a break even on the bottom line, coming back now to the bottom line page, is not going to get you there either. So you don't just need to break even now. You need to restore, let's say, $500,000 or $1 million a year to your working capital, and then after two or three years, you'll be back to a very healthy, normal position with your finances and your cash flow. So I wanted to point that out sort of as we go along. When I get to a stopping point here in a moment, I'll be glad to take questions. I'm not trying to confuse anyone by any means, and I'm certainly interested in taking your questions. But let me finish the going through the numbers, and then we'll get to that. On page 6, you'll see the statement of functional expenses, and these are the expenses categorized by the normal expense categories. For nonprofit accounting purposes, you really have to show your expenses both ways. And by that I mean you need to show, of course, what they were for. Was it for salaries or office expense, et cetera? You also need to show how much of that expense was dedicated to your programming versus how much went to overhead or how much went to fundraising, which is important information for the donor to consider when they're donating to a nonprofit organization. What we see here is that the total expense for September 30, 2011, $14,612,000. If you turn to the next page, I'm on page 6 now, and I'm asking you to turn to page 7 as well to see the prior year number. The year before, it was $15,375,000. So the expenses did go down about $700,000. You'll notice for the very astute observer, which I hope you are, you'll notice that there are a few anomalies in this report. We don't have a schedule yet. We don't have a breakdown on the rent. So you see all of the rent combined, radio rent for office, studio, and tower all combined in one line. We will be breaking that down once we get the schedule, and it will be a similar breakdown to the year before. Let's see. What else did we have? Also, there's the storage portion of the rent is not broken out. We do have the legal settlement fees broken out. And one thing I do want to point out about the legal cost and legal settlement cost is we're displaying the whole settlement cost before reimbursements. The reimbursement for some of those legal settlement or legal fees you will see later on under miscellaneous income. So I'm anticipating you to ask me what is a miscellaneous income, and it is reimbursements for legal settlements or legal fees. Again, we have the current year on page 6, the prior year on page 7, so that you can compare numbers from year to year. Next is the cash flow statement. Oftentimes, people weren't, now I'm sorry, I'm page 8, right. I will often get the question, Ross, you just told us that our cash went up by $200,000, but you also told us that we have a deficit for $400,000. I don't really understand. The purpose of this page is to address that question. So in the top of the page, you see that you have a deficit of $405,000. At the bottom of the page, you see that you have an increase in cash of $192,000. What are the differences that went into that, into those numbers? Well, depreciation, $272,000, is a non-cash number. It reduced your bottom line to a deficit, but it did not reduce your cash. Some of the cash was classified into restricted cash. So that's broken out on the cash flow report. The other receivables increased. Other receivables decreased, which provided cash flow. There was acquisitions of equipment. If you look further down the page, for $93,534, but often I'm asked about depreciation. What is the difference between depreciation and your actual cash flow? Well, in this case, for this year only, you allowed $272,000 for depreciation, but you actually only had to spend $93,534 in equipment replacement cost. So that was a positive effect on your cash flow. Another key item here is the deferred rent liability, which I was explaining before. It's being charged to rent expense, but actually it was not a cash item. You didn't actually have to pay the $61,077. It was just an accounting entry. So that's an explanation of why your cash, another part of the reason your cash went up, in a year that you actually had a deficit. So if you deferred rent, yeah, deferred rent was an accounting entry to recognize a rent liability that means that in a future year your rent will be going up, and you'll have to pay more rent in the future. And we're recognizing it now and expensing it now to even out that rent commitment and even out that rent expense. But in the current year, $61,077 is listed as rent expense on the prior page. When we were talking about rent expense, it's included in that number, but it wasn't a cash rent expense. It was an accounting accrued expense, not an actual cash item. So it goes into this page to explain why, again, you had a deficit of $405,000, but your cash actually went up $192,000. $100,000 of a CD was used to pay off a line of credit. That's the $100,000 there. Yes, if you look further down the page where you see bank line of credit, this was a CD that was used to pay off a line of credit. So it's a use of cash that reduces a liability, and it's shown as coming out of cash flow, even though it was not an expense. It's just using a CD to pay off a line of credit, but it does affect the cash flow, of course. So I'll be glad to answer more questions about that as we go along. That's the cash flow statement. Now returning into the footnote pages, there are extensive footnotes. Really, these footnotes are, in my opinion, too extensive, but some of these are required by accounting rules, which now want additional verbiage referring to the specific accounting standards and codifications that are used to justify the accounting policies and procedures in place at the organization. A lot of it is just sort of boilerplate language. I'm going to move along to the most relevant footnotes. We don't have an allowance. I'm sorry, I'm now on page 10. Even though it's page 10 of the report, it's the next page of the footnotes. The first page just talked about basic accounting policies. The second one goes into some of the specific categories. Under allowance for doubtful accounts, in the prior year, we had allowed $98,000 out of the pledges receivable as an allowance for uncollectible pledges. That may seem to be a fairly low number, but actually what we're doing is, since we're issuing the report in January or February, we're able to look back and see how much of those pledges were actually collected. If it was pledged in September, for example, how much of that came in October, November, December? And then we only estimate about, in most cases, around 80 or 85% of the deferred income items, pledges that were made on a deferred payment basis that were, you know, historically very confident are being collected. So we don't really have a need for a large allowance for doubtful collections, because we based most of our receivables on real collectible receivables. But the number is not entered for this year. We don't have the work paper developed for that entry. I don't anticipate, again, a significant a change to the financials from that entry. Next, page 11. It refers to basic accounting policies and principles again regarding donated facilities and services, functional allocation of expenses, which we covered already, estimates. These financial statements are based on estimates. Depreciation is an estimate, for example. How much of the pledges receivable may not be collected, that's also an estimate. So it's not an exact science, but the idea is that if you're doing a proper job with the financial reporting and also with everything that goes behind it, the bookkeeping to begin with, and your procedures, then you should have a pretty good idea, a pretty good estimate of what some of these items are in terms of depreciation or collectible receivables. So the actual results could differ from a certified clean opinion financial statement because of the use of estimates, but they should not differ in any significant or material way. And that's explained as the accounting principle called using estimates. Next, we have property and equipment, explaining that items over $2,000 are capitalized and the depreciation methods used for each category of asset. On to page 12. We don't have a number listed for compensated absences. However, that entry had been made just prior to completing this report. We just don't have it in the footnote. But the accrued vacation pay entry has been completed. So, again, I'm not anticipating any change at all to the financial statements in terms of accrued vacation pay. That accrual has already been made. We just don't have the number for the footnote yet, but we'll be getting it. Under investments, again, we don't have a reconciliation yet for the unrealized gains and losses. I'm not expecting that to be a significant number, but we don't have it as of the date of this report. We have made the necessary adjustments to the financials already to mark the investments to market values. So there would be no change to the financial statements once we identify the exact amount of unrealized gains and losses, and that should be a minor number, and it would be no adjustment to the financials because it's already been recorded properly. On page 13, moving on, we have some recent accounting pronouncements. Again, these are FASB pronouncements and codifications and principles that are required to be disclosed concerning what constitutes restricted or unrestricted funds and the rules that govern the use of restricted funds. And the references are there if you want to look up the accounting principles on those standards. This report is in compliance with those standards. There was a line of credit. It had been paid off, as indicated earlier. So there is a footnote on the line of credit just because it did exist at the beginning of the year, but there is no balance at the end of the year. Under restricted cash, we have itemized cash in restricted accounts. These are separate bank accounts for specific purposes, and you'll see it by division listed in this footnote as what constitutes the restricted cash and which division does it exist. The major item there would be the WPFW building fund. Moving to page 14, we have an analysis of the property and equipment. It's listed as a combined number on the financial statement, and in the footnote on page 14, you see the composition of property and equipment from land to building and improvements, leasehold improvements, furnitures and fixtures and equipment, totaling $13,329,000 versus the year before $13,235,000. The difference is that $94,000 acquisition number that we talked about on the cash flow statement. So the assets did not increase that much during the year, only by about $94,000. You have the accumulated depreciation and then the net book value after depreciation showing net asset fixed assets at September 30th, 2011 of $2,712,300. Some of these assets came with a NTIA grant money, which restricts the asset so that you cannot dispose of the asset within a 10-year period. Assets that were acquired with that restriction are being disclosed here by division, and those restrictions, the year that that restriction ends, is also being identified. So most of these assets, actually the restrictions are up in 2012, and there's 73,000 up in 2013, and then a small item, 19,000, that's up in 2016. So unless there's new NTIA grant money used to acquire new assets, just about all the assets are being released from those restrictions. Moving to page 15, we're disclosing the value of the investments. We're disclosing both the original acquisition cost of the investment and the current fair market value, which means if it's listed as a security on a marketable exchange, the value is at September 30th. So, for example, on the equities, you'll see equities were acquired at $146,000. They've gone down in market value to $121,000 at September 30th from whatever date they were originally acquired at. That pretty much reflects the market realities. So in the next part of the footnote, we're explaining how much of the investment income, $38,873, was from interest and dividends and how much was from realized gains and losses. Although we do have a number there, it's in bold and there's a question mark because that work paper has not been finished. Those numbers should be very close, but they're not exactly reconciled at this point in time, so there could be a minor change, which, again, would not affect the financial statements. It's just a breakdown. Temporarily restricted net assets, as we were mentioning before, these are funds that had come in as restricted with donor-imposed restrictions and had not been utilized for those purposes by the end of the year. So at the end of 2011, we're reporting $265,800 $200,000 of which was the building fund at WPFW, and $65,800 is the building fund over at WBAI. And that's all that we have as restricted funds at the end of the current year. On page 16, yes.
We hadn't stopped to do Q&A. Yeah, I would rather let Ross get all the way through the presentation, and then we'll take questions. Try to make notes on any sections of which you're particularly interested. Go ahead, Mr.
Okay,
President.
Yeah, I'll be glad to address questions
Thank
at the
you.
End.
Yes, of course.
Page 16, temporarily restricted net assets. These are net assets that were released from restrictions. A donor may restrict a donation or a grant by stating that they want it used for a particular purpose. Or they might say, you know, we're really donating to your next year's budget, which means it's just restricted to next year's budget. But either way, it's a donor-imposed restriction, and we will show it as temporarily restricted funds until those funds are used in accordance with the donor's wishes. During the year, the current fiscal year, there were $363,854 of restricted donor funds that were used for the intended purposes, and we call that released from restrictions, and then they can be used through the general funds for the intended purposes. So a lot of this is the CPB restricted portion of the grant. As you can see where it says CPB grant, for example, KPFA, $78,919, that is not the total amount of the CPB grant. That is only the portion which was restricted by CPB for a particular use, which was for programming. And that was used basically for free speech radio programming purposes and other programming costs. So that's just disclosing by division and by grant type the funds that were used during the year for that had been restricted and were used during the year and no longer restricted. The next section is permanently restricted net assets. These are essentially endowments where the principal is to stay in a permanent fund, but the income from these funds can be used by the organization. And you'll see that broken down by division. Basically, KPFA and National Office have some endowment funds that are invested in the endowment accounts. $375,000 of endowment funds are actually held by the San Francisco Foundation on behalf of Pacifica, and the income is available to Pacifica. However, due to the decrease in market values, there was no accessibility of income from that fund during the current year. I'm just throwing that anecdote in here in anticipation of a question later. But there is generally income accruing on these permanent funds that is available to the organization. On page 17, it explains the rules concerning permanently restricted funds and the related accounting policies involved for the organization. And then we get to page 18, and I want to highlight footnote number 10, concentration of risk. There were no bank balances in excess of the FDIC-insured limits. That's the first paragraph, so there was no exposure there. We are also, which is routine in financial statement footnotes for any organization, for-profit or not-for-profit, to disclose concentrations of risk. Well, what do we mean by that? Well, if you have a lot of debt with one particular vendor, or you have a lot of revenue from one particular source, that could be considered a concentration of risk if it's over a 5 or 10% of your budget, because what happens if you have a problem with that particular relationship is does it endanger the organization? So, of course, it's of great concern to this organization that the CPB funding continue. So it is listed as a major grantor, Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which provided $1.5 million last year and has been renewed for the current fiscal year. Of course, it's on a year-by-year basis, so we don't know about next year. But, you know, so far, so good with CPB. And I'm sure as the CFO will discuss later, there was a – a CPB audit that was conducted that seemed to have gone fine. So the other concentration of risk item is Democracy Now. We're disclosing the amount due to that organization. That is an item of concern. However, there doesn't seem to be a problem with that payable at this time. So, but it is disclosed as a significant payable of the organization. Note 11, lease commitments. This is a required footnote to show as the amounts of the leases become due. This is network-wide, of course, how much the legal entity, Pacifica Foundation, as a network, owes on its lease commitments. So the reader of the financials knows that there are signed leases and there are future commitments to pay those leases. And those are the amounts broken down by year. There is a footnote on the pension plan describing both pension plans, the 403B and the 2% so-called profit-sharing plan, which is, of course, kind of a misnomer. It's called that because it is generally a discretionary plan where the percentage can be varied that goes into that plan. But the organization has a 2% profit-sharing plan. Under pending legal matters, there's a paragraph on commitments and contingencies. We are still awaiting letter responses from several of the law firms to see if there's any pending contingent liabilities from legal situations. I'm not aware of any at this time that would affect the financial statements. Once we get those attorney confirmation letters back, they will tell us if they feel that there is a contingent liability, if it's measurable, if it's probable, and if so, then we may have to make an adjusting entry to accrue an amount for that. I'm not anticipating that entry. It's just that we haven't finished the audit. I don't have the confirmation letters yet, so I can't say for sure until I hear from the attorneys. The next footnote is the communication attorneys, the FCC. Again, not aware of any issues. Certainly as it would affect the financial statements. But again, we're waiting on a final confirmation. I believe that actually has just come in, and it was a good confirmation, meaning that there is no item to be disclosed there. Income tax, of course, it's a 501c3 tax-exempt organization, as disclosed in footnote 14. Next, footnote 15 is concerning grant revenue, and then in the footnote disclosure, we break that down so that the reader can see not only by division but also by grant source. Of course, the primary grant source is the CPB, which is the second column, and then other foundation grants are listed in the third column by station and by division. We also have the same information disclosed for the year before, so you can compare the 2 years. On page 20, there's a description of the SCA income for the year, for both years. That actually went up a little bit. I understand that the national office was successful in gaining a few new SCA contracts. A basic description of central services, a basic statement that subsequent events have been disclosed, that again is pending the completion of the audit. I'm not aware at this time of anything of a material or significant nature that would affect the financial statements, but until we actually issue this report, which we're hoping to do towards the end of February, we cannot close the chapter on things like subsequent events or contingent liabilities. If something does pop up, we would be disclosing it in the financial statement. And then last but obviously not least is the footnote number 19, ability to continue as a going concern. I'm going to read the footnote, but I want to preface it that, I'm not sure that whether this footnote will be in the final report or not. If I had to sign off on the report today, it would be, but I have not seen the financial recovery plan and the projections that go with it. I don't know if it's been adopted, and I'm not sure if there's enough progress to remove this. But again, I will read the footnote. For the past 4 years, the foundation has sustained losses of $433,000, $2.7 million, roughly $2 million, and last year $405,000. For the years ended September 08, 09, 10, and 2011, totaling $5.5 million, roughly. Also, during this four-year period, working capital has decreased from $2.8 million at September 30th, 07, to a deficit of $880,000 at September 30, 2011. These conditions and events have given rise to a substantial doubt about the foundation's ability to meet its obligations as they become due without substantial disposition of assets outside the ordinary course of operations or restructuring of debt or externally forced revisions of its operations or similar actions. Although management has taken recent action to increase revenues and reduce expenses, as of the date of this report, there is not a board-approved and implemented financial plan in place in order to restore adequate working capital within the current year. Accordingly, substantial doubt remains as to the ability of the foundation to continue as a going concern as of the date of this report. And, of course, I'll be willing to entertain questions on that. The rest of the financial statements are a breakdown of the organization-wide financial statements by division. So starting on page 21, you'll see the same balance sheet numbers in the that appear in the totals column, which we already covered on page 2 of the financial report. You'll now see that on page 21, but then it's broken down by division. And sometimes I'm asked to explain about eliminations. Since Pacifica is really not composed of separate legal entities, it's all one legal entity, then the interdivisional transactions are eliminated in order to provide the organization-wide report. So you will see, for example, if one division has a liability or receivable with another division, then obviously those debits and credits, if you will, offset when we combine the financial statements and provide the consolidated balance sheet and income statement. So you'll see those amounts that have been eliminated under the eliminations column, but we do that so that you can also see under the divisional columns what the divisions have on each of their set of books as an intercompany or interdivisional receivable or payable. And that, again, has been divided into a current portion versus a long-term portion. The current portion is with all current assets or all current liabilities. They are reported as current on the basis that they are expected to clear within the next year. So something that's reported as a current receivable or something that's reported as a current payable on September 30th is expected to clear by the following September 30th. Otherwise, it would be a long-term item. So to provide a little further explanation, for example, you have a mortgage, a 30-year mortgage. A portion of that mortgage is due in the current year. That would be a current liability. And the rest of that mortgage is due in future years, and that would be considered a long-term liability. So that's why we have this delineation between current and non-current. And it becomes very important when you're coming up with this number called working capital, and it does affect working capital. The eliminated items do not affect working capital for the network as a whole, but they do affect working capital for each division or each station. Page 22 is the liability section of the balance sheet. Again, the totals column reflect the same numbers as you've already seen on, I believe, page 4 of the report. Now we're on page 22, and the totals are the organization-wide liabilities and net assets. The eliminations are the amounts that are interdivisional items, and then we have the liabilities broken down by division with the five stations and the national division listed. PRA, again, is included in the national division for this report. On page 23, you have the income statement, the statement of activities by division with the revenues listed by division, the expenses listed by division. This is in two sections. The top section is the unrestricted fund section. The bottom section is the temporarily restricted fund. The only real difference between the top and the bottom here is you have CPB grants as restricted funds broken out coming in. That agrees to the restricted column on the, I think it's, what, page 4 or 5, I'm not flipping back now, of the organization-wide report. But it's, since we have to show it by division on this page to get it all on one page, we've listed the first top of the page as unrestricted, the middle section as temporarily restricted, and then the bottom line is the total amounts. And these numbers agree to the overall numbers on for the whole organization already covered on page 4 or 5, I believe. So, again, you will see organization-wide where you'll see $358,000, rounded as $359,000 as a decrease. We're still on page 23. We've broken down basically the bottom line into two components here. You'll see $358,985 as a deficit under the unrestricted fund section, and you'll see $46,982 as the deficit under the restricted fund section. Those two numbers add up to the same $405 deficit that was previously listed on page 4 or 5. And this is broken down.
What page are you on, Mr. Isman?
We're on page 23.
Thank you.
Okay. Moving to page 24. This, the first page were the total expenses. Now we have the functional expenses by division. So now you see, for example, personnel cost by division. Whereas on the previous page, you just saw total expenses listed as either programming, administrative, or fundraising. Now you see the total expenses by expense category, personnel cost, advertising, promotion, et cetera. On the next page, page 25, you'll see functional expenses, and these are now just expenses for program services by division. And then on page 26, you'll see functional expenses, but these are just the expenses for management and general expenses. So, for example, if you're looking for legal fees or audit fees, you may not see that on the first page because it's a management and general item, and you'll see it on page 26. And then going to page 27, you'll see the fundraising expenses, and here's where you will see personnel costs devoted to fundraising, the premium cost devoted to fundraising, and any other related fundraising cost. Going on to page 28, we have the miscellaneous income page, which breaks down some other forms of revenue. There are tape sales, which are it's a PRA revenue stream. There is affiliates income that's reported under the national division. And then there's some other miscellaneous income. This is primarily insurance reimbursements on the legal fees and litigation. Down below, there's a breakdown of the investment income. There might be a minor adjustment. That's why you see question marks there between how much of that income is interest and dividends versus realized or unrealized gains and losses. That would be a very minor adjustment, and it does not affect the total income. And that concludes the description and the explanation of the draft report financial statement for Pacifica for the year ended September 30, 2011.
Thank you, Mr. Wisdom. Now we'll take questions from board members. I'll take a stack. I've got George, Tracy, Bill, Marcel, Campbell, Nia, Ivan, Alex. Okay. Well, is there a motion to extend time?
So moved.
Can you specify amount? 15 minutes. Is there a second?
I'll second that.
Is there any objection to extending time, 15 minutes for Q&A with the auditor?
Without objection.
Thank you. Without objection. George?
I'm trying to find it. I'm unable to get you out. Mike, is this working?
And if I get you out of order, I apologize. So many hands went up all at once right there.
Okay, hello, hello, hello.
No, I've got it, but I'm... You got a mic?
These are working.
This one, oh, okay.
Hello, hello.
There may be things that are working on the stream that aren't working in the room.
Now it's working.
Hello, yes, that's working.
Feedback.
In terms of income, there was an item which was about $300,000, which was other income. And it didn't include, for instance, events that were produced by the stations for raising. What's in that?
Okay. If you look at the very last page of the report, where it says other revenue by division, you'll see the total other revenue is $355,722. That's broken down by division, and it's also broken down by type of income. So, for example, there was $52,632 of tape sales, of which $52,432 was actually PRA, $200 was KPFT. There was affiliates income of $217,465 under national, and then there was this other miscellaneous income, $85,625, which were primarily consisted of insurance proceeds on an insurance claim to reimburse for legal.
Thank you.
Next is Tracy.
Hi, Rose, and thank you for your work. I have a question that relates to the statements of functional expenses, which is page 6 and page 7. And it's a question about some year-to-year consistencies between the fiscal year ending September 2010 and the fiscal year ending September 2011. In terms of assessing how we're spending our money, it's certainly helpful to go from one fiscal year to the other and be able to make end-to-end comparisons. And this particular statement of functional expenses, it, I guess, corresponds to the 990 split between program services, management, and general, and fundraising and development. When I look at this, there are several categories where from year to year, although the foundation as a whole spent approximately the same amount of money, there are really substantial six-figure shifts in the allocation, specifically between program services and management and general, that, speaking for myself, I'm not clearly understanding why these would have occurred. So I'm going to point out what I'm seeing, and maybe you can give me some idea what criteria was used and what accounts for the large shifts.
Okay, go ahead.
From year to year. The first is communications expense. Again, we're spending a similar amount of money, but we seem to have switched from a 2-to-1 program to management split.
That certainly looks like a
from
mistake.
From 1 to 2.
And that certainly looks like a mistake. Yes.
Okay. Depreciation and amortization, same thing. We're spending about the same amount of money, and again, the split is changed by more than six figures.
Right.
The third category, to go down to the bottom, is utilities, where we have a $100,000 shift. And the fourth category is a new one, website and audio port expenses. And my question there is, to my way of thinking, and perhaps I'm not correctly understanding this, audio port is largely a program service that we provide. So I would have thought the brunt of that income would have been classified as program services. So I just wanted to point those four things out and either, you know, ask for some explanation of the criteria or just suggest that perhaps they could be reviewed.
We're in the process of reviewing it. We do not have a detailed analysis of functional allocations. Basically, there has been an analysis, and the entries have been made to properly book the payroll by department. Some stations break things down by department properly. Some stations do not. The ones that do not, we rely upon either the national office or sometimes between my office and the national office, sort of very much like you and I are doing right now. We would go through and we would spot these anomalies, and we would say, was something misposted, and we would go through it, and I'm sure everything you just highlighted is going to be adjusted. So thank you, and if you'd like a job, let me know.
Okay, thank you. Bill is next.
Thank you so much, Ross. First, I'd just like to make a point out something that a number of people have recognized. Under, you know, we're not really a $14 million operation. We're about a $50 million operation. It's just that most of the labor is donated. I know that doesn't show up in the financial statements, but you know, I think we need to be aware of that. Also, I was had a question on page.
Let me to speak to that question, because it's a common question, and in Pacifica's case, it's not only a typical question, it's a very important question. You know, the volunteer aspect of this organization is huge. This is probably the largest also democratically run organization, especially a nonprofit. So it's quite commendable. Unfortunately, accounting principles do not allow us to really recognize that. They only allow recognition for professional services, legal, accounting, and technical services that otherwise would have to be paid for unless they were donated, and certain in-kind contributions of equipment or items that are otherwise would have to be purchased and are measurable, especially volunteer services, unless they're professional. It would be difficult to determine the value of that, and accounting principles actually tell us not to record that in the financial statements as a bookable accounting revenue or expense. That's why we have the footnote on page 11 to explain that.
Okay, yeah, I understand that. I realize the accounting principles, but you know, people could also argue all of our volunteer program producers are also professional. But anyway, I did have a question though.
Okay.
Page 22. I don't understand some of these interdivision payables. For instance, it lists $300,000 for KPFT as a payable. I don't know where it comes from. It's a non-current one. I don't know if the other stations have the interdivision payables are listed correctly.
What's the question again?
On page 22, statement of financial position by division, non-current liabilities. Interdivision payables, KPFT, for example, shows about $300,657 as a payable.
The reason we have these numbers broken down between current and non-current as well is because the non-current liabilities, the $1.4 million, dates back to, I think, around 2000, the year 2000, 2001. When there was a financial crisis at Pacifica. And it should mean that money went from the network to KPFT, or there were charges incurred at National on behalf of KPFT. But that would require some research. Ultimately, it's fairly inconsequential. It's the reason it's under non-current is it's not expected to clear. Right.
I just think it may not be correct, but there may be other similar figures. If you can check it when you get a chance, I appreciate it.
Point of information.
Yes.
Is Bill referring on page 22 to the $300,000 under KPFT under interdivision payables?
Yes.
And your question, I'm sorry, and your...
There is no mic right here. Oh, there you are.
And you're suggesting that there is, that should be what?
I don't think KPFT owes that. I don't think it exists, but maybe there's something I don't know about. Even going back to the year 2000.
All right, thank you.
But, you know, maybe it's attributed to the wrong station or it's in the wrong category somehow. But I just don't know where it came from. And I'm from KPFT, so...
Thank you, Bill. Ross, did you have something further on that before I go to the next person?
No.
Okay, thank you. Marcel, you're next.
Okay. Can you hear me? Okay. This is a general question, but it's really important to me because I'm from W, and we need to move, and we have been running into some difficulties. Some of them center on Pacifica itself with us as a going concern. I'm not an accounting professional, so I'd just like to know how badly does this affect us, and will it continue to do so if you decide that indeed we are still a going concern?
Okay. I think there's an aspect of that that is better addressed by the CFO, but I will address it as the auditor and as the accountant. The purpose of the going concern is to alert the reader that there is a some substantial doubt as to the ability of the organization to continue to pay its bills as they become due. In Pacifica's case, it's really not so much that it's going to go out of business. Obviously, it hasn't gone out of business. It's still in business. I don't really think there's a serious concern that Pacifica is going anywhere. However, there is some concern about its ability to pay its bills on time. How severe is that? Well, if things are improving against a plan that you've got a proposed solution on the table, you're making movement towards that solution, then that footnote can be removed if the substantial doubt can be removed. So that's how we look at it as auditors. I mean, I think it was, I hate to misquote the firm. I don't know if it was Arthur Anderson or which firm it was. It was one of the major firms. They issued a clean, unqualified financial statement opinion on a bank in Pennsylvania that went out of business the very next day after they issued the report. And, of course, that was not a... That was an embarrassment to the accounting firm. I'm really not that concerned about the existence of the organization, but I do need to see just a little more grounds for removing the substantial doubt as to the ability of the organization to pay its bills.
Marcel, are you done? Okay, Campbell, you're next.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would say that I'm also from WPFW, and we do have that kind of a concern. I was noting some of the CPB restricted funds, trying to locate that at present, and there's a sizable difference between last year's totals and this year's totals. Was there a change in policy, or who has these temporarily restricted funds control over them?
All right. I believe that there was a substantial change to the financial statements issued in the year 2008, and perhaps the CFO can address this better than I can, but I believe that affected the CPB funding for the following year, so it was reduced because CPB funding is based on listener support, and that financial statement had to be corrected, and that reduced listener support, so it also had the effect of reducing CPB funding for the following year. The year right after that, the CPB funding was essentially restored. So that's why you might see a change in CPB funding from one year to the next. But there was actually no change in policy about the restrictions on CPB funding.
But you're saying there's a change in Pacifica's policy with regard to accounting for them, or what?
No, if you recall, in the 2008 financial statement, there was about a $1 million overstatement of revenue that was subsequently corrected. But I think CPB funding had initially been based on the incorrect, and then they corrected. And so you had a shortfall in CPB, a reduction in CPB funding in the prior year based on prior year's financials. Now, once we submitted last year financials, and I think the year before was okay, so you had 2 years of financials in a row that were okay.
Okay.
Then CPB was restoring its funding to the former levels.
Okay. Madam Chair, if I may,
before I allow you to continue,
yeah,
Campbell and Mr. Wisdom, I'd like to let Arlene have some information.
That's exactly what I was going to ask.
Thank you.
There was also a difference in this in the last year because they gave some recovery funds, and those did not carry the same. We would have seen a substantial decrease in CPB funds last year if it had not been for those recovery funds, and those recovery funds did not have the same requirements that the general CSG grant from CPB does. So this overall standards have not changed. Right. The same amount is restricted for programming expense, but those recovery funds were different.
Thank you, Arlene. Campbell, did you have something further? Well, y'all, I hate to be the bearer of bad administrative news, but
yes.
We're at the point where would someone care to make a motion to extend a little further?
So moved. 10 minutes.
10. And I see Teresa's hand. Were you moving to move that?
I want to move that we extend 20.
Thank you. Is there a second to the Campbell? Do you wish to withdraw
second.
The 10 and second the 20?
Yes, I withdraw.
Okay.
The
problem. All right. Thank you. Is there any objection? Don't you do that. you really object to 20?
Object.
I'm curious to know how long this is going to continue. Or
20 minutes.
Can questions be given to him?
You're more than welcome to object. Generally, we do take a generous amount of time with our professionals when they're with us to answer everyone's questions. So if there are still questions, we usually do extend. But do you wish to object?
Okay.
Thank you, Ivan. Okay. Any objections? Okay. Thank you, folks. Hearing none, we'll extend for another 20. And but Campbell, being mindful of other people's time and many people on the stack, what else did you want to ask?
Let me let other folks on the stack go first.
Thank you. That's considerate. Nia, you're next. I got you.
Here's the mic.
Thank you. Hi, Ross. Thank you for your report. I have many questions, but I will be unselfish as usual. So let me try to ask the ones that are sort of popping out at me or priority to me. In terms of WBAI's building fund, page 15, I know that in that September when we were in D.C., that there was zero there. So I need to understand, did you see a bank statement that has $65,800? I'm just trying to figure out where did this...
15 was the page she referenced.
Where did this money come from since September and now that you're doing the audit?
Oh.
That's number one.
Okay, on page 15, we're reporting temporarily restricted net assets. It's not being reported as restricted cash. It's not in a separate restricted account. You don't have to segregate restricted funds, although I do recommend it, and it is advisable, and it should be, but it's not required. The $65,800 reflects a donor restriction which has not been removed, although the donor has allowed it to be used temporarily for other purposes as long as it's replenished. So that's why you see it under the building fund for WBAI, but you don't see it under restricted cash, if that's your question.
Okay. So although... I'm so sorry. Because... Is it... So you're saying some parts are restricted?
No.
When the donor says we may... That we use it, and we put it all there. I'm so sorry. I'm a tad confused.
I'm sorry. Let me try to be clear. I'm not saying that some part of the $65,800 is restricted or unrestricted. I'm saying the $65,800 represents temporarily restricted net assets. The donor asked for the $65,800 to be used for the WBAA building fund. Last year, the donor was communicated with and informed us that it was okay to use the funds for working capital purposes on a temporary basis as long as they were eventually restored and ultimately used for the building fund. So that's why there was in the station has not had the cash to put it into a separate restricted cash account. So the station still needs to restore these funds, and we do recommend that the funds be placed into a restricted account. However, we have had no objection from the donor for the temporary use of the funds for other purposes.
Okay.
So that's why you see,
okay,
you still see it as $65,800 restricted on one page, but you don't see it as restricted funds on another page.
Okay. Okay, I guess I'm just, I was just confused between the, excuse me, Teresa? Okay, but I can manage my own speech, thank you. The next item is the, in terms of the non-current liabilities, where the interdivision payables are.
Right.
These numbers, you did not create the allocations of the dollar amounts. These numbers were given to you from the national office?
These are per the general ledger. So, and
page 22?
Yeah, let me go to page 22. Let's see.
I lost my other one. Okay. I'll let someone else go, and if I have time,
right,
I'll come back on this.
Right, these are per the general ledger. Right.
Okay, Neil.
I know what it is. The from KPFT, the grant, we're saying that, then that's verified that that money should not be booked all at once. It should be prorated.
It's booked. It was received $120,000.
But it has
there
to
is
be
a refundable provision that, in event of a termination or default, that the unused portion, it's prorated over 7 years, is refundable to Rice University. So as long as we have that refundable provision, or unless it's removed, we show
right.
it as deferred income over that period of time. Each month, you will achieve more income just from an accounting entry. The money's already been received. They're not asking for the money back now. I'm not saying that they are. But per the terms of the contract, it's listed as deferred income until it's earned, so to speak.
Yeah. That makes sense. Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, Nia. Ivan, you did not wish to be on stack anymore. Is that correct? Go ahead. You would be next.
I just want to make a quick statement that I appreciate the conversation. And my objection before was the fact that not enough sufficient time was given to us to read the documents. And now we are extending time for Q&As. And I'm just trying to foresee the validity of this. That's all.
Thank you, Evan. Ali, you would be next.
Thank you also for your report and thoroughness and patience with our questions. I was originally going to ask the same thing Campbell did about the CPB grant funding on page 16, but since that was covered, I'd also like to ask you about section 9 on page 16, the permanently restricted net assets. Are these recurring endowments that happen at the same amount every year, and is there a way for us to know what the restrictions are on these specific endowment funds?
Okay. No, they are not recurring funds. These are not income items. This is funds that were received in prior years that are in endowment accounts, and the income from these accounts can be used, but the principal remains. So that's why you don't see a change in the number from 2010 to 2011. That's an account balance. That's not an income item. So the Pacifica has about $1.1 million in endowment funds, and it can use the income from those funds, but not the principal.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next on stack is Alex.
I wanted to ask you about the footnote 19.
19.
And I guess
yes,
it's kind of a general question and maybe a bit of a hypothetical question. Mm-hmm. The going concern issue comes about as a result of our negative capital assets.
Working capital.
I keep mixing up those terms. Sorry. And your recommendation is that we should have, that's on page 20.
Please speak directly into your microphone, Alex.
Oh, I thought I was.
That's okay, thank you.
And your recommendation is to see working capital to the tune of $1.2 million for our organization, and we're currently $800K in the negative. Now, from the past year to 2010 to 2011, we went from a deficit of almost $2 million to a deficit of $400,000. So that's an improvement of more than $1.5 million in the last year, although we are still in a deficit, granted. Would you say, then, that if this trend continued, that we would, you could remove the doubt about the going concern issue? In other words, if we have a three-year financial recovery plan that has a real a realistic plan to, say, accumulate in terms of a well, I wouldn't call it a surplus, but say add an extra half a million a year in the next 3 years, or half a million, maybe more like 700K over the next 3 years. By the end of that period, we should be pretty close to a $1.2 million dollar surplus. We would, if we had such a financial recovery plan in place, would that be sufficient to allay your concerns about our going concern? And we are of course working on a financial recovery plan, and I hope we'll be approving. We'll have one approved by the board very shortly.
Well, that's exactly what I've been saying. Those were my recommendations a year ago, is that there needed to be a financial recovery plan that was approved, and I've also been recommending a three-year projection to go along with that, and then you'd like to see some progress made against that type of a plan. Fortunately, I do not have to sign this report today, so there's still some time to approve a plan. I don't know if I'm going how much success there is going to be against that plan. I'm certainly open to being receptive to a realistic financial recovery plan, but I'd like to see some progress being made against that plan as well. So.
Thank you.
Lydia?
So this is on restricted funds. Would you be able to make some recommendations beyond having a separate bank account? For example, when we have a donor that gives us and earmarks it in some way, that we also specify that if we're going to use it for our general expenses, if there's a sunset to that, if that should be part of our practice. That's one. The other thing is that a few months ago, Andrea Katz, who's working as development and working on the building fund, and so she was surprised to learn that there was a building fund at WBAI, because she had some mechanism, some matching fund type of donation. Could she truthfully still invoke that restricted fund that's not really there or hasn't been put aside, or can she just not use it until that money is put back into a separate account?
Excellent question. I don't know that I can answer it. You would certainly be able to do it with donor approval. You would have to speak to the current donor, get documentation. You'd have to speak to the matching program department and see whether they're willing to match funds that have been made but not segregated into a restricted account. We have always recommended separate restricted accounts. There has been progress made in the last few years by the business managers to properly record when they do receive restricted funds into the proper general ledger account, showing that it's restricted money coming in. But you also need to understand that there are situations where you might have a restricted fund that's
not necessarily segregated. It obviously cannot, if the donor wishes it to be in a segregated account, you need to honor the donor's wishes, of course. There's no law that you're in violation of by not having it in a restricted account. It's just not a good accounting practice. It's an excellent question, and you're really putting your finger on something here, something that has been a problem in the past for the organization to do things properly, but they've made progress, this organization, with doing things more properly. And I do think that it's something that would be very important to someone like Andrea Katz and other development directors, because if they can honestly say, we are collecting these funds, we are holding these funds, and we have something to build upon, I think you will have a more successful fundraising effort that way. So I think you're asking the right question.
Thank you, Lydia. Ken?
Hi, thank you. Mike? Okay. Thank you, Ross. I'll speak loudly until the mic comes on. I just had two questions. One is regarding page 15. This is just from a novice. I don't understand why the value of our investments is less than the value of acquisition, and I don't understand why it looks like they decreased in a year where the market generally went up. I'm probably misunderstanding it. And my second question is a totally different subject, so let me hold that. Can you explain that on page 15? Well, how come the values are declining when the market's going up?
I wouldn't know without going to the work papers, which I don't have with me, exactly which investments we're talking about, which acquisition dates we're talking about. So I don't know when they were acquired. But what this is stating is that they were purchased at $146,299, and the fair market value on September 30th, 2011, was $121,47. So you have...
Okay. So the acquisition could have been like 5-10 years ago.
We don't know. I would have to go look.
Okay, yeah. Now I understand it.
Right.
Okay, my other question is, we had some discussion on several finance meetings about whether or not it's appropriate to include depreciation in budgets. Mm-hmm. Is that anything you examined or could advise on?
I have advised on that already, and I'll be glad to repeat myself. For those of you who have heard my talk on this already, bear with me, but there are two approaches. It's a very common issue with all of our nonprofit clients. What do we do with depreciation in the budget? It's a little confusing. I understand that. There's basically two approaches for dealing with it. One approach is, the primary approach. Let's put them in order. The primary approach, the most advisable approach, especially where you have capital needs and you need to have a capital plan, is you should have a capital budget. So let's say you have a capital budget, and then you would have an operating budget. And then in your operating budget, you would not have depreciation. But then in your capital budget, you would have an opening capital balance. Do you have any capital reserves already for equipment or capital acquisitions? If so, you have a capital opening balance. And then you have, during the year, perhaps a reserve. Perhaps you're requiring X amount of dollars, which might approximate depreciation. Depreciation is supposed to approximate replacement cost. But you would independently determine what you need to reserve that year for future asset acquisition. And then you have another line for your actual acquisitions during the year. And then you would have a balance at the end of the year. What that allows you to do is also throw in some other line items, like capital financing. So let's say you need to finance the acquisition of an asset, or you need to otherwise have some sort of financing or capital campaign or fundraising. You might have your fundraising that's restricted for capital, a capital campaign, coming in just to that budget. It wouldn't be in your operating budget. So you can segregate everything that relates to equipment, major equipment purposes, a move, what have you, in this separate budget. It would be a cash in, cash out, and a balance kind of budget. And then you would not need anything like depreciation in your operating budget. So what do I mean by the other approach? Because this first approach is the standard and usually recommended approach if you have significant capital items that you need to plan for. Some organizations don't really have major capital items. I know that Pacifica is not one of those organizations. But some nonprofit organizations, they will leave depreciation in their budget, so to speak, but they will rename it estimated replacement cost because they buy a lot of laptops. And every year, they need to buy more laptops. But we're depreciating the laptops, let's say, over 5 years, which should probably be 3 years. But let's say we're depreciating them over 5 years, and they really need to replace them at least over 5 years. So they're going to leave depreciation in there because they need to allow something for buying more laptops, and laptops doesn't go in any other line item. So in that budget, you'll see some of our smaller nonprofits, and instead of having depreciation, they'll call it replacement costs, but it happens to be the same number or a very similar number. I don't know if that answers your question, but those are the two basic approaches. And in Pacifica's case, it's really up to the finance committee. It's really up to the organization. But I would normally expect to see a capital budget in this type of an organization.
Okay, thank you. That actually clarifies things. Mm-hmm. Because you explained it in lay terms that woke everybody up, I think.
Like fresh hot coffee. Thank you, Mr. Wisdom. Revelin, you're next.
Okay, thank you, and thank you for the report. A lot of questions I had have already been answered. So noting that on page 6, the legal fees are $406,677, and that on 7, which would have been the previous year, they are $244,000, and that's so they have almost doubled, and they're all under management and general. So I guess that is true, and that is something that we should all take note of, because it's probably curable. And then the last statement that you made about why we are listed at not the value we really are, because you cannot note that so many of our people are volunteers. Could you say that again? Because we are, even if you can't today, by tomorrow we should be able to do it. Because we are.
And I agree, you are. And what I could do, and I would be glad to do so, is write a more elaborate footnote on that subject. I could state the number of volunteers. I could state an estimated value of their services in the footnote. I just can't book it as revenue to the organization or as expense of the organization under current accounting rules. But I certainly understand where you're coming from. I'm certainly on your side, and I could do it in a footnote, but I can't, as a CPA, do it in the financials.
Today a footnote, tomorrow the world.
One footnote at a time. Teresa, you're next.
Thank you.
No, Teresa, and then Heather. I've got you all, don't worry.
I would like to add to I certainly agree with that, and our ability to get grants would certainly depend upon how well we document our volunteer hours. For example, the chair of our board is an attorney, and if he were doing work for us that he would ordinarily bill $200 an hour for, if we documented that, we could say, we have volunteers putting in, X amount of value. So certainly that would help for us when we apply for grants. And he's called that to my attention. You look skeptical, Lydia. But, we certainly do have a lot of people that are putting in, thousands of dollars worth of volunteer work if we documented it.
Yes, there probably could be some more of that done if we had documentation for it. Please understand that even if we did that, it would be in and out. It would show up as revenue. It would also show up as expense. So if you have an attorney saying, here's my billable hours, it adds up to $5,000, but you know what? take it as a contribution. You have contribution revenue and you have legal expense for the same amount. So it doesn't affect your bottom line. It, of course, shows the world the real amount of value coming into the organization. And in an organization like Pacifica, as well as many others, volunteers play a huge role.
Heather's going to be the last person on stack because we're at time in the public session, and we do have executive session with Mr. Wisdom to go over our management letter, so there will be other opportunities to ask him more in-depth questions. Heather? Oh, I'm sorry. I apologize. I also have LaVarne. We'll finish the stack, Heather and LaVarne, and then we're done with this portion.
I also want to thank you for your report. And I'm a director representing the affiliate stations, and I would so appreciate a footnote talking about the volunteer time, and if it were possible to also include something in there about the affiliate stations themselves. I mean, Pacifica now has one of the largest radio networks in the country. It's really quite significant. We're expecting more income this year from the affiliates. The other thing I want to mention is that the affiliate task force is going to be doing a survey of our affiliate stations this year, which should give much more of an indication of the breadth of our audience and the usage of some of the radio programs coming from Pacifica and so forth. There's more I'd like to talk about that. I'm not going to spend time on this right now, but it would be wonderful if in that footnote you could somehow incorporate something with the affiliate stations as well. We have about 170 of them.
Could you please send me an email?
I absolutely
describing
will. Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I was also wondering where that income from the affiliates was placed in the budget, sort of general. If it was possible to break it out somehow, that would also be good. I don't know if you can do
it
that.
It is broken out under the other revenue section on the last
that very
the
last page. I know. I kept wondering, and then I saw, okay, so here it is on the last page. Okay, thanks. I'll send you an email.
All right.
Are you done, Heather?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, thank you. LaVarne, and then we'll be done with this portion.
Okay, excuse me. Thank you, Ross, for the work that you've done, and that we have the staff and Ross's firm. We've been working together a lot over the last 2 months, and it's been a challenge, but I think that we're going to get there by the end of February. But the point I just wanted to make was on that Ross had pointed out was on the CPB funding and why we had the decrease. And, you know, I think we just need to say that again, because when we talk about these issues, they tend to, like, be forgotten. And the point that Arlene had made was we got the funds from CPB, which was the additional funds that came from the Obama administration, I believe, not recovery funds, but the other, those were the funds. But the big item, as Ross said, was due to the fact that in 2008, they overstated revenue. In order to make the result, I'm sorry, did I say the revenue was overstated by $1.6 million? So that had to be restated in the next year. So that's why we had that decrease in funding from CPB, and that's something that is just totally, you know, puts the foundation put us in a very bad position, because. If it was consistently stated, you know, if there had been an increase or decrease, it would have been over. It would have been smooth over that period. But instead, there was a big drop. But fortunately, we did get the increase in funding from the in order to help supposedly the economy through CPB. So we did get those funds. And this year, we actually we weren't really certain, because we have had a decrease. Not really, and we've had these huge losses over the last 5 years. But what we do have is that we did have a slight increase in CPB funding this year, which was good. And but that's basically the reason why we had this big drop in CPB funding, because the revenue was overstated in 2008.
Mr. Wisdom, did you have a comment on that?
Yes, I'll. That report was done by the former auditor.
I'm sorry, I meant to say that.
Okay. The The pledge as receivable were overstated, as well as a major donation that was accrued for, I believe, the WPFW gala.
Yes.
Anyway, I did not do that audit, but it was restated in the 2009 audit. So those audits are submitted to CPB. So when they see a large number in 1 year, and then it's corrected the following year, there's like another year time lag before it affects your CPB funding. So then we've had 2 years where it's been back to normal without no major accounting adjustments, and so the CPB funding has been restored. So it although it cost you in 1 year, you got overfunded by CPB the year before because of the inflated numbers, and then they adjusted it back, and then it started being restored. So I think that does warrant a full explanation. But I'm glad it was pointed out that there was sort of a up and down nature to the numbers. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Wisdom. All right, everyone, thank you. We've had a nice long discussion. For members of the public, the public session will resume at 2 p.m. We're going to go into executive session with Mr. Wisdom to discuss aspects of the draft audit report, which are part of the management letter. And we invite you all to come back at 2 p.m. for the CFO's report. And thank you for being here this morning.